Hello, 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 hello. This is tape two of the interview with Charles Evers in Jackson, Tennessee, February 12. You're going to talk more about the murder and the trial, you said.
Yes, I was just saying, when we were boys, I remember, as I said before, the Senator Bilbo said once in Decatur on the courthouse square that someday, if you don't stop these Negroes and keep them in their place, they'll be in Washington trying to represent you.
Now, may I? It's all right.
That was when we were just boys. And the funny thing about it, when Metcalf's body was carried to Washington after he was assassinated, it didn't bother me too much. I had never broken down until we got to Washington. And as I sat in the limousine waiting for him to bring his body out of the church in Washington.
And what church was that, man?
That was the... I don't remember what church it was. I guess I shouldn't be...
I can find it. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
When they rolled him out of the church and rolled him and put him into the hearse, and as we began to pursue to the cemetery, it all came back so clear that many years ago, Bilbo predicted this. And Medgar and I said the same thing, and now here we are, here, representing all our people in Washington. And that was the time I broke down. I had never broken down before. But just seemed so real, and the prediction had come true. Although he didn't mean in that sense. But the point of it was, we were there. And we were representing all the people. Not Negroes, but all the people of Mississippi. Because, as I know, the tragedy that happened to him affected everyone. White and black. Indians, Chinese, Japanese, and all. Because they know, too, that until all of us are free, and we are free from this type of intimidation, that none of us are free.
What effect did this have on white people in Mississippi? I mean, not the murder now, but the fact of this, the official funeral in Washington. Do you know what effect that
had? I don't know. I have a lot of calls and quite a few friendly letters stating that they thought it was a very dramatic thing, and they thought it was a wise decision for us to make to have him buried there.
From white people in Mississippi?
Yes, from white people in Mississippi. Although they remain anonymous and they didn't give their name or their addresses, but they did call. I often get calls from many whites telling us to keep on. Just keep it up. Don't give up. Keep it up. Because victory will be ours. But and people wonder, why did I come back to Mississippi? Well, actually, I never left Mississippi. I was just vacationing, should I say, until the time was right for me to return. So I had promised Medgar and I promised my people when I left that I would return. I'd return to carry on the job that I felt that Medgar and I don't know why, could do better than anybody else in the world in Mississippi, because, as I said before, it's something that we wanted to do, something that we felt that we should do. Something that's not... We didn't do it for fame nor fortune. We did it because we feel that every American has something he can contribute towards equality for others. And I could have been a wealthy man today. Metcalf could have been a wealthy man. But we didn't choose that. We chose to stay here and stay a part of our people, to stay poor with them, but try to be able to become informative. And be able to keep them informed and to help to raise the standard of all of the Negroes and all the people of our state, not just myself or Medgar and his family or one or two others. Because we could have so easily turned our back to this situation, and Medgar would have been alive today, and I could be with my family, and we could be living in the luxuries of the other world and forgetting all about that there are thousands upon thousands of my people who need us.
I know it's true to a degree, everyone says so, it's written about, but there was, and to some degree is now, a split between the prosperous Negro middle and upper class and the masses of Negroes.
Yes.
How much is that prevailing in Mississippi now?
Actually, it prevailed all over the United States. No point in us fooling ourselves. We know it prevailed in Mississippi because, as Metcalf and I always felt, that this is something that has to be a part of you. And most of our wealthy people feel as though that they have no part to play in this. I have everything that I want. Why should I destroy myself? Why should I deprive myself of my, treasures, of my happiness and my comfort to worry about some drunk down the streets there, or to worry about some illiterate down the streets there? Why? I prepared myself. Why can't they? As I said before, it's something that has to be a part of you. And Medg and I keep repeating, had the same opportunity that these people had. And I'm not being braggadocious. We had a chance to become rich, and I still have the chance if I wanted to. But I don't choose richness. I choose to be a part of people, to be among the people, and to be to have something to offer people, and to be able to help people who need help.
Now, that split between the prosperous middle class among Negroes and the general masses of the Negroes been lessened in the last few years here?
Yes, I would say so, in particular in Mississippi. Some of our leading supporters now are some of our wealthiest Negroes. I'll admit they don't stand up and holler from the treetop or from the housetop as loud as I may do it, or as loud as Metcalf did. But they are supporting us 100%. And actually, I think that there are very few Negroes, rich, poor, beggar, whatever the case may be, that are not with us in this movement. I have never been turned down anything I've asked them for, regardless to who they are, bootleggers, whether they are legal operators or illegal, they still support us indirectly.
Have the black Muslims come into Mississippi?
No, they haven't, and I have often wondered why.
They're in Louisiana, of course. They're fairly active there.
I understand they are, but I wondered what happened there, why they haven't been into Mississippi. As I said before, there's room for all of us here, and if they want to come in, I'm sure they can get accommodated. But I don't think they will come in.
But they're not on your side, of course.
No, they are not on anyone's side. The black mob was on their own side. They're an extremist, and as Metcalf and I have said many times, that we don't believe in extreme groups one way or the other. I don't believe any more in black supremacy than I do in white supremacy. I want every man to have an equal opportunity, and every man to be treated as an American, not as a white or black, not as superior or inferior, but as an American, and that's it. And I think that a man should be characterized and should be judged as an individual. Whatever he is, let him be that. It's not my duty, or not the society's duty, to classify anyone. Therefore, I don't believe in the Muslims. I don't believe in what they stand for. I'll admit that we have a few things in common. And, for instance, they feel that they should have an opportunity to do what they want. But I don't believe that. I don't want to be in an all-black state no more than I want to see an all-white state. I don't want to have the right to knock you down and kick you around because I'm a Negro. No more I want you to knock me down and kick me around. I don't want you to not hire me because I'm a Negro. I don't think I should feel though I should not hire you because you're white. So you see, we have many differences there, and I don't agree with them at all.
I understand from people in the movement in Mississippi and elsewhere in the South, but there's sometimes resentment of varying degrees of intensity by the local Negroes against the whites who come in to work with the movement, to work with the various organizations, who come in either from adjoining states or from the North, or even who are local people, Mississippi people who join the movement, white people, young white people who join the movement. There's varying degrees of resentment against this. Not always, but often enough to be observed. I'm told this by various Negroes in Louisiana and Mississippi.
Well, that's true. It's true in Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, for the simple reason. And it's quite understandable, I think.
It's understandable, yes. But I want to know, what are the reasons?
The reasons are, number one, the Negroes just don't trust white. And the reason they don't trust them, because we Southerners have been built up and been mistreated so badly by whites, it's hard to believe that any white man, unless you are intelligent enough to reason, that thinks enough for you to come down here and sacrifice all the things that he has to see you get the thing that you want. And only the intelligent Negro and the Negro who's concerned about the movement and the Negro who knows that there's someone who believes in Christianity, who believes that there's someone who cares enough to give the very best.
Now this is all off the record, of course, we'll put it here, but as background material, Mr. Moses said yesterday that there was real resentment about the fact that some of the whites were better educated than the mass of the Negro workers, and there was jealousy about the command posts they would achieve quickly because they were better trained. There was some real jealousy developed that way, and it was a problem to keep this under control.
Well, as I said, maybe Mr. Moses would know more about that than
I would. He says that.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know that. I can't see where that would be. Speaking of NAACP, when I say we open our arms and our doors to the most learned person. Because
sure
we feel that the more brains that we get into our organization, white or black, the better it would be. Because we feel that the white have had the opportunity to be exposed to the type of thing that we are fighting for. And the more of those we can get involved into the movement, into fighting for freedom and legally and spiritually, the better it be for all people. So I would say that in my organization, in our organization, that we don't feel that way. We are glad to have.
Yes, you have been attacked by Adam Clayton Powell on that point too, of course. You attacked the NAACP,
well,
you see, on that basis of having this the white membership and the white officers.
Well, Congressman Powell is a very good friend of mine, I must say that. He's a very good friend of my brother's. And I think that, as I said before, in fighting for this freedom, we must also realize that a man has a right to think and to react the way he pleases, as long as it does not intimidate or incriminate anyone else. Now, I don't know whether he actually feels that way or not. I've read where he said things, but on the other hand, he's offered to come and speak for me here in Mississippi. And maybe there are some things that he don't approve of. But
Jack Greenberg's apartment.
Pardon?
Like Jack Greenberg's appointment to the NAACP Education and Defense Fund.
Well, as I said before, I guess maybe that's an individual thing, and I don't have too much comments on, against or for Congressman Powell. I think he's a wonderful man, and I think he's done a lot to help to advance the cause. But I imagine that as any other individual, that there are some things that he lacks, some things he doesn't like. And that there are some things he approve of and things he don't approve of. Now maybe he feels that there should be a Negro head of the NAACP. But I don't feel that there necessarily has to be a Negro head of the NAACP. I feel that there should be a human being head of the NAACP, whether he's black or white. It doesn't matter. What we are fighting for now is equality. And I feel that if I'm going to discriminate against you because you're white, and so you can't be a part of my organization, then I'm destroying all the things that I'm fighting for. Or that the thing that I do speak louder than the thing that I say. So I don't think maybe he actually meant that. Maybe he did. That he didn't want whites a part of it, because I'm quite sure that he associates with many whites.
Oh yes, he does.
And I'm quite sure that he meant of his on in his very beginning into the political world, like somewhere a white man must have helped him to get in a position where he could get the support of the Negroes of Harlem.
Maybe he thinks the Negro voter of his constituency wants to hear this.
Well, as I said before, people have reasons for doing things. I'll say that back to late Senator Bilbo. Now, Senator Bilbo was no more against the Negro than any other white. But Senator Bilbo knew, in order to stay in Washington and get that fat salary that he was receiving and live on the flower bed of ease, he had to come back and lambast and discredit Negroes.
Yes.
Now, if Senator Bilbo, as an individual, did more for individual Negroes than any governor we've ever had.
You mean ones he knew?
Ones he knew. And as he's the man who contributed more. He began to contribute to building the state institution, new buildings at Alcorn. During his administration, we received more than any other time until him, more than to recently.
You think he was acting as a matter of trying to head off the attacks on separate but equal by making the Negro schools more nearly equal, or at least improving them?
That's possible, but...
That's been true in a pretty general sense of the 54 decision.
Well, this was before then that he was doing these
before
type
that,
of things.
But he could predict that, perhaps.
Yeah, and maybe he could see that that was coming. Now, why I'm saying that the Senator Bilbo wasn't as vicious, actually, within as he pretended he was, because there are so many indications, so many incidents where that it's been proven that he was not only a friend to certain Negroes, but he was even intimately with certain Negroes.
Yes, yes.
And it has been rumored that he even has children in down in Poplarville now.
Yes, I hear that.
By a Negro woman. So you see, then he couldn't have been as bad against Negroes as he pretended. But he used this on the ignorant whites because he knew they would know him better. That's what they wanted to hear. And so I'm saying all that to say this, that a lot of time our leaders, our people who are out front, people who are being listened to, will say things, to please the ears of the listeners. Now, it doesn't mean he actually feels that way. I could even go to a more recent thing, but I won't do it now because maybe it may hurt him. But I think it's going to be proven even in Mississippi in the near future that things have been said by certain persons were only a mean of acquiring certain positions, and they really didn't feel that way.
That's sometimes said about the present governor.
No comment.
I haven't asked him a comment. You can strike the record anytime you like, you see. It's very strange. We think of the South as one thing, you know, or Mississippi as one thing. Now, yesterday I read the editorial in the Commercial Appeal, the Scimitar from Memphis. It was a fairly intelligent editorial on the Civil Rights Bill. Did you see the editorial? It just said this. It said, the Senate had better pass this bill because it's the will of the United States and it's the benefit of all. It said so flatly with no equivocation. Big editorial, prominently placed in the Memphis paper. Right there yesterday. This would not be possible in Jackson, I'm sure.
No, they, you know, our Attorney General has already said that if the bill is passed, as far as Mississippi is concerned, it never existed.
Yes, he said that. But Memphis is not far away, and Memphis, West Tennessee, is in many ways lumped together with North Mississippi.
Right.
The Delta capital.
Right.
Yet that paper will say that.
That's still go back there. I tell my people all the time. In Memphis, there are many registered Negroes.
Yes,
there are many voting Negroes. Therefore, the politicians and the newspapers are afraid to come out any other way. And until Negroes in Jackson, Mississippi, and Mississippi decide that we're going to become registered voters, these politicians are going to always holler. Now, our Attorney General wouldn't have said this had we had 150 or 200,000 Negroes voting in Mississippi. He wouldn't have said that.
But a few years ago, I was down at Glendora, just at the time of the murder of young Melton by Kimball.
Yes.
And later on, people there, I interviewed the widow just after the event, and I talked to many people in Glendora. The people in Glendora, almost to the man, were horrified. And they signed a manifesto, you know,
yes,
expressing this.
Yes, sure.
Yet the trial came along, and there was a quick acquittal. We know that story.
That's right.
But in the Clarksdale paper, when the acquittal took place, there was a front page editorial saying this is a miscarriage of justice, saying we have flunked it again.
That's right.
Now, that man who wrote that editorial in Clarksdale, Mississippi, and put it on the front page was not doing it in a town where Negro voters were a power.
Right. But that was an individual.
An individual.
And a man
but he had nerve.
Who had nerve to stand up his conviction. But there are such few of Mississippi.
There are a few, yes.
Such few. And I said before, until Negroes get registered and voting, we can always find that type, that few, and that's scant group who will eventually come out and speak out the truth.
I've heard 50 white men in Mississippi at one time or another say they admired that man. Now, many of those were segregationists by ordinary standards.
You know, the funny thing about this white Mississippi white man, he admired any man who stands up for what he believes. Now, they admired Metcalf. Sure, they admired him. They didn't particularly love him, but they admired him because he stood for what he believed. Now, that's what I tell my so-called informers and snitches and narcotons, we call them, that no one respects that type of man. No one respects you. I believe in any man. And that's why when I go all over this country, people criticize me when I say that in Mississippi, we are freer than Negroes are in Chicago and New York. The reason I said, because we know where this man stands. No question about it. We know what to expect here. In Chicago, New York, you wonder. They rub you down, they grin your face, and stab you in the back.
Now, would you can project what you said about the admiration of courage in the Mississippi segregationist, even, to say that he's easy to deal with in a way, even if he's putting the gun on you. He still respects you because you're standing up to
that's
him.
Right. Sure, I said that, and I've always said that, and that's what I live by.
That's then there's some basis for dealing with him in the end, then.
That's right. Because, see, once you convert him, you'll be just like it was when Christ converted Peter. You have a converted man who's on your side. But the sympathizer who go along and pat you on the back all the time and feel sorry for you, in the end, he'll still be patting you on the back and doing absolutely nothing. And once we can prove to the Mississippi whites, the staunch segregationists, that what we are fighting for is right and just, then Mississippi will be the best place in the world to live.
When do you think that crack's going to come, either on or off the record, either way?
It can be on the record. It's all right. I don't mind saying it. I think the crack will come when more Negroes and white become concerned about the state and the nation and realize that what we are doing here is useless and it's fruitless and it's going to destroy all of us. And when Negroes become more and more determined to become registered voters and to become recognized and to become accepted through their own efforts.
When do you think you can send a Negro to the legislature? Anybody's guess, of course, but how would you date it as a prospect?
Well, I would say it'd be at least a decade.
A decade.
I'd say at least then.
Some say 70. Some say 68. You know,
No, I doubt that, seriously. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be at least 10 years before we can send a Negro to the legislature, even the state legislature. Mm-hmm. Because, see, whether you want to admit it or not, this is a long, drawn-out thing. Mm-hmm. We aren't going to settle for nothing, but we're certainly going to take time to get it all.
What does freedom now mean with that realization?
Freedom now...
Interpret the slogan for me as you feel.
Freedom now means that we don't want to wait until tomorrow to start getting the thing that we're entitled to.
To push for it,
to push for the thing we're entitled to. We're going to push for them now. We're going to ask for them now. And we hope to get some reaction, some favorable reaction now. But we know that no social change come overnight. But for God's sake, start making some change.
Yet I've encountered people, mostly I must say younger Negroes, who would say, no time is going to be involved tomorrow morning or not at all, now or never, now or death, you see. Or another type will say, well, I know it takes time, but I just can't bring myself to say so.
Well, actually, as you said, they're young people, and I'm glad to hear them say that, because that let me know they are willing to go out and fight for what they believe. But they will learn, as all of us have learned, that nothing comes today. From the birth of a child, it takes 9 months to materialize, 7 to 9 months. To become a man, it takes from 1 to 21 years.
Or one to never sometimes.
I want to never. So you see, it's a thing that we must, but it doesn't mean that we aren't growing every day. It doesn't mean that we aren't getting or our eyes not becoming open, we not being able to walk, we not being able to crawl or walk or talk. Every day we get something new. But it's no point us fooling ourselves. Nothing comes now. But we want some action now. And we want to start working in the direction of freedom now. And I think this is my interpretation of it, that I can't speak for anyone else.
Sure.
And I'd like for this to be clear. That freedom now means we are not going to sit idle by any longer and not do anything about the injustice that's being inflicted upon the Negro and minority groups. We're going to demand that we have the right to register and vote now. Not tomorrow, but now. And let's start getting the Negro registered and voting now. And if we can't get it, we're going to use every legal means as possible to get our rights. And that's my interpretation. Maybe I'm wrong, as I said before. It's just like if I would go out and call my wife up and say, look, I want a whole chicken for dinner now. Well, I got to be a mighty big eater going to eat a whole chicken with all the trimmings. But what I mean is, prepare the chicken, I eat all I want and all I can now, and then tomorrow I eat the rest, and the next day I eat the rest. But I think that there's no point in us fooling ourselves, that you just don't get it now. But we gonna have some efforts. We want some compensation. We want part of it now. And I'm willing, and Metka was willing, to make progress, not drag our feet, but as hurriedly as possible.
This is an important point to have on the record from a person in your position, because it's misinterpreted by both Negroes and white people sometimes. Slogan is taken as more than a slogan. It's taken as a notion of abolishing the historical process entirely. You see, it sometimes is, and the white man will say it's impossible, and therefore it resists. The Negro student, usually a student, will say it means now. We're going to have it tomorrow morning, or it's going to be blood in the streets.
Well, as I said before, neither one of us never appreciated. We never did. Advocate violence.
Yes.
And I still say that.
Yes, I know your views on that.
And I still say that it's going to take time. But we're not going to sit and wait for time to solve the problem. I don't want anybody to get that impression.
Yeah, I understand.
But we're going to fight for everything that's ours now. But we know it's going to take time to acquire. I'm building a brand new home here.
Yes.
I can't build it today, tomorrow. It's going to take time. But every day they're working on the house.
Yes.
And I want that house completed. I don't want to wait 100 years to complete the house, don't get me wrong. But I know they can't build the house and complete it tomorrow. I don't care how much money it costs.
There's no matter
how much money I can say, here's $100,000, I want my house built tomorrow. That doesn't mean a thing. It's going to take time.
There's no magic.
Build it. There's no magic. And that's the same with our rights. We want progress every day, something. And we don't bite no bones on it. We want progress every day.
I was talking a few weeks ago with a young lady who is extremely brilliant. She's second in her class in the law school at Howard University. And we were sitting having lunch with a group. And she started the conversation, said to me, I have more hope of working out a way of life here in the South, just in Washington where we were talking. And she's been all over the South. She's been in the picket line. She's been in jails. She's been through it. She said, I have more hope of working out a decent arrangement here than I have in the North. She said, Detroit and Chicago and New York scare me to death. She said, at least there's something in common in the background, the common history of the Negro in the South and the white man in the South. That we have some understanding, some recognition of each other as some human shared history. She said, this seems something to build on even if the policeman is shooting at you. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. It does make sense. As I said before, when you break down these walls of these staunch segregationists, I still believe that you'll have more assurance of a lasting freedom than you would have in the pseudo-type you have in the North. I have to agree. And I think regardless of how much I'm different, how few are different with me, that's my belief. And a man has to have a belief. We've always had that. And that's why Metka and I were willing to stay in Mississippi and die in Mississippi. But we feel that there's a hope for Mississippi. And there's a chance that someday that Mississippi will be a better place to live for all people.
I wish you'd speak now to any point that's on your mind, anything that's on your mind. Let me drop questioning, and you just say what you, anything that's happened to be, to occur to you, that you think is important to say.
Well, the most important thing that I would like to say in my closing, I guess this is the closing,
all right,
is that I hope and pray that the day will come when Negroes and white alike in Mississippi can sit down and negotiate their differences and reach some conclusion without interference from agitating whites, as they may call us, and agitating Negroes too, if they think that we are certain groups agitated. And I hope and trust that the line of communication can be established between the political power structures of our city and our state and the local citizen. And when that day comes, then and not until then will things in Mississippi or any place else be accepted by the masses and enjoyed by all. And that's about all I have to say. I hope
you think that, say, the power structure, as it's called, of Jackson would decide to negotiate, you could trust them to negotiate?
Well, as I said,
if they decide now they won't negotiate, of course.
But I believe if they decide they will negotiate, I always believe a man is innocent until he's proven guilty.
Yes.
If they will sit down and say they will do something, I'll be the last man to say they wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I believe if they have the conviction and the courage to stand up and fight as they are fighting, and say they aren't going to negotiate with us, and I think should they see it deemed necessary to negotiate, I do believe that they will do some of the things they say. It's been proven. They said they would give us 6 policemen, and they gave them when we got them. They didn't give them to us because it was ours, and we would do them, but they did do what they said. They said they would give us 8 crossing guards, and we got them. So you see, it's one thing about a Southern white man, those who are in position. In most cases, once he say he'll do something, if you can get him to stand up and say he'll do it, now not in all cases, now, but in most cases, if he's a leader or if he's in a position to make decisions, once he commit himself, you can just about trust what he says. Not all cases now.
Sure.
But in most cases, you can just about trust, because he's going to fight so hard to not to do it. And I found out one thing about some of them, and I like in writing, I like to be sure to emphasize on that, I'm not speaking of all, that if they give you their word, they hate to be made out of a lie.
You mean by the time they stand up and make the agreement, they've already crossed the line within themselves?
I think so. I think so. Now, they aren't going to give in until they have to. That's one thing for sure. We never would have got the police here unless they saw it just deemed necessary. We'd been fighting here. But they found that they had no choice and that we were not going to stop until they gave us something. And this is not all we want. We want more. But as I said before, I'm a great believer in that thing is just not done overnight. But give us some of it every day and every week, and I think we'll be able to get along. Because bloodshed have never solved any problem. I think a good example of violence is Birmingham. Birmingham was the worst disaster that could ever happen in America. And actually, the whole line of communication has been destroyed among the white and the Negroes. And no one's getting their place there. They've got to get together in Birmingham, and in Jackson, and in Tupelo, and in Greenwood, and Clarksdale. You've got to be able to get together on the local level and solve their problems among themselves. And until that day comes, it's going to be a hard place to live. It's going to be critical for people to live.
There's the federal troop solution. It's not a solution, then, you're saying. Is that it?
Well, the federal troop,
yeah,
I can't...
By itself, I mean.
By itself, no. It's a good... In some instances, good to have for protection. But what we're going to have in Mississippi and everywhere is an understanding and a feeling and a will to accept each other on the local level. Now, sometimes troops may help to bring about that, but I still say troops won't change the hearts of people, and it won't change the mind of people. But I think that if we continue to push what we are pushing for and stay right and keep on fighting the way we are fighting now, that our many hearts going to change. When those hearts are changed, then Mississippi will be the best place in which to live.
But troops sometimes change hearts a little bit, though.
Yes, I agree with that. And also, it's good protection. I feel that we'll need troops in Mississippi before this thing is over. I hate to think that, but I do feel we're going to need troops here. We need federal protection now.
Well, you needed troops in Oxford.
Yes. We need federal protection now. Why I said the troops have to change, that's something I may differ from you on that, because once they get to know the Negro, sometimes troops can help them to get to know a Negro because it gives a chance to associate and mingle with them, and then they begin to know us. Because even the northern white, a lot of them don't know, most of them don't know the Negro. You have your ghettos and your Negro sections and your white sections there, the same as you have. Look at the trouble they're having. So you see then that it's a fact of lack of understanding among both races throughout this country of ours what's happening in this turmoil. And until, as I said before, hearts are right, and the churches can play a great part in this, in making people understand that they are human beings and they are individuals, and every man has a right to be respected and looked upon as an individual.
How much of the churches in the South losing their hold on the younger people now?
I don't have that. I couldn't say and be accurate in it, but
sure,
I can
say. Sure, nobody has statistics.
But I can say that I think that the churches themselves are losing some of the younger people because of the lack of interest that's shown towards the movement. And a lot of them are very reluctant to speak out and to give the youth a hand or give them a leadway to go out and to do things. Therefore, they're returning from, some of them are losing memberships, and they're turning from the church to the civil rights movement because of the activities there.
Negro colleges have been in a very peculiar position sometimes, too.
Your state colleges, yes. Mm-hmm. But your private institutions have been very helpful. The state colleges, naturally, are controlled by the state segregationists, the state power structure. And they use that as a weapon to keep the officials of the colleges suppressed, because they say, now, if you do this, you won't have a job. And I said before in my previous statement that most persons are concerned about themselves, especially those in the high echelon, and they won't give up their personal things in order to and sacrifice themselves for the benefit of others. Therefore, they have that the state officials are able to control our state institutions so far, but that won't last much longer either, because people are beginning to realize that I don't have anything anyway, so what have I got to lose? And that's about the attitude we're taking.
This has been great.
Thank you very much.
It's very valuable.
Thank you. I hope it can be of some...
Well, it'll certainly be useful, extremely useful.